that have you here. And I will turn it over to Tom Ricks, who is a senior fellow here at the Center for New American Security.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. Welcome to CNAS, the little think tank that could. For me, this book, Defense of Jazeera Dura, began a couple of years ago when I got it in email form. And I just about fell off my chair. I read it and really liked it, partly because it stands on the shoulders of one of the great military classics, which is reprinted here, The Defense of Duffer's Drift by A.D. Swinton, a British publication coming out of the Boer War, which for me was really my introduction to understanding tactics, in the sense that tactics constantly change, that the only successful commander is the agile commander who responds to events as he sees them and understands them. I think these guys did a brilliant job of updating that and putting that in the context of the Iraq War. Through their use of dreams, I think they also pulled off a kind of surprising stunt, which is that in some ways this book is a history of the Iraq War. You could call it Dream 1, Dream 2, Dream 3, or you could call it Year 1, Year 2, Year 3, and so on, which means I expect you guys to do a 10-chapter sequel at some point. 2 points I want to make at the outset. They have a website, defenseofjad.com, which I think is really innovative and shows the spirit in which this book was written. Something else that shows the spirit in which this book was written is that they are not making a penny off of it. All royalties are being donated to the Fisher House to take care of the families of the wounded. They are active duty military. I think it shows some guts to publish this because there's always going to be people who criticize them. But in your questions to them, do remember they're active duty military. There are some things that they simply are not in a position to talk about. One final thought on this. E.D. Swinton is remembered most for his book, The Defense of Duffer's Drift, which, as I say, is also republished in here. Swinton, about 15 years later, was on the Western Front of World War I, and in 1914, had an idea, the tank. What that brings home to me is that innovative thinking in the military doesn't mean you're just innovative in one area. Here was an agile, thoughtful officer who really showed how to perform in a counterinsurgency environment. 10, 15 years later, in a high-intensity environment, he conceives of the weapon that defines that war. Which means I expect you guys to go on and develop stealth infantrymen or something.
Absolutely.
With that in mind, I turn it over to Mike and Jim and invite you to fire away.
Well, thanks, Tom. Thanks for the introduction. It's going to be kind of hard to top everything you just said right now in my discussion, but I'll give it a shot here.
Should we maybe go around the room and introduce ourselves
yeah.
before
I forgot that.
So we get a
Sorry.
Sense of who's in the room?
Okay, I think that's
fine. Yeah, I'm Tom Ricks. I'm here, and I wrote a couple of books in the Iraq War.
I'm Greg Ryan. I write for Military.com and DoD+.
Jason Fritz, I'm a consultant there, and sort of with Mike and Jim.
Yao from Xinhua News Agency, Washington, Europe.
Well, that's the time for the Office of the Chairman, George Smith.
I'm Price Floyd. I'm the Director of External Relations here at the Center for New American Security.
I'm Wilson Coe. I'm from Corporate Engineering and Technology at Lockheed Martin.
I'm Mike Burgoyne.
I'm Jim Markward.
Garrett Mitchell from the Mitchell Report.
I'm Ashley Hoffman. I'm the External Relations Associate at Center for New American Security.
I'm Richard Downey from the Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies.
I'm David Cloud. I'm with Politico. I used to be associated with CNAS.
Jesse Eckert. I produce This Week in Defense News.
My name is Nick Masalas. I'm a research intern here at CNAS.
Brian Burton. I'm a research assistant at CNAS.
Seth Rosen. I'm a research intern here.
I'm Michael Zuber. I'm a research assistant at CNAS.
Brendan Fogarty. I'm a Marine Corps major. I'm a fellow for Senator Casey.
Travis Brad. I'm general counsel of an internet security company or an international counseling area.
I'm Ed Winfield. I work for British Home Stuff here in DC.
All right. Fantastic.
Anything else I forgot?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, Shannon, thanks for putting it all together. And then everybody in CNAS, thanks for you guys' support over the last several weeks. And everyone here, thanks for taking time out of your schedules to come and eat some Arabic food with us. It's been pretty delicious so far. Got my hands all greasy. But I had a guest that showed up yesterday from out of town, and what I decided to do was take them to Arlington Cemetery, which I'm sure you guys have been there a whole bunch of times, and went up to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And there's that one soldier that walks back and forth. And I was watching him, and you know, and he has 21 seconds, he waits, then faces about, or faces to the right, and then walks 21 steps. And what I was thinking is, no matter how much things change around him, the environment changes. So it's the weather, or his uniform, or anything else, the spectators, even the soldier himself might change, the one that's executing it. And even the technology that's going on over several decades, the fundamentals haven't changed. It's still 21 seconds. It's still 21 steps. The discipline is still there, and the excellence of American service member that's executing that fundamental hasn't changed. And so as I kind of wrapped my head around that, I was thinking, well, if I think of all the problems that I have in my life, you know, personal, professional, you know, we tend to get, at least I tend to get wrapped up in the moment with everything that's happening, technology, all this, all these buzzwords and everything else. And at least I personally, and it doesn't just take a second to think of a problem at any level. And think about it. The solution, usually all it requires is to go back to the fundamentals and just look at them and use some adaptive leadership, be creative in applying those fundamentals in a new creative way to take care of some of these complex problems and to come up with different solutions. And so I was thinking about that, and that's sort of what we try to do with the book, The Defense of Israel Dorea, as far as fundamentals were for COIN. So we focused the first few chapters on specifically the on defense priorities, how to set up a defense, engagement areas. And then after that, we focused on at the tactical level, key ways to apply counterinsurgency so that anybody who could pick up the book would hopefully be able to, regardless of the organization they're in or the conflict they're in or the location they're at, they can grab those lessons learned and kind of apply them and be successful with them. And obviously, it's going to require a little bit of creativity. So Phil Connors, he's the main protagonist in the book. And early on in the book, he falls asleep like any good lieutenant does. And falls asleep on a plane to Iraq. And as he falls asleep, he dreams. And he has a whole bunch of dreams. There's six dreams. And through each dream, he gets a little better at applying counterinsurgency lessons. And in the first dream, he's given a mission by his commander to go out into this town called Jizr al-Dorea and set up an outpost. So he goes down there, and he's wrapped up, excited and whatnot, and goes down there and violates all the fundamentals and really quickly gets defeated by insurgents. He gets overrun. And he realizes, holy, well, got to watch my words, but he realizes, hey, it's a military side of me, I guess. But he realizes, hey, I violated the fundamentals. And so, and I'll quote from his lesson, the fundamentals still apply. Counterinsurgency operations and low-intensity conflict do not negate the value of systems time-tested in countless conflicts. When establishing an outpost, it is critical to employ the fundamentals of defense, seven steps of develop an engagement area, and the priorities of work. So I remember me and Mike were both lieutenants back in 99 and 2000 at Fort Carson, Colorado. And you remember, Fritz, as well, how much they drill in these basics into your head. And for the first few years, we focused on high-intensity conflict. And counterinsurgency wasn't discussed, at least at our level, at the tactical level, back in 99 and 2000. And even right after 9/11, we deployed to Egypt in support of Operation Bright Star. It was October 2001, so literally just a month and a half after. And we went out there and, you know, we maneuvered with our Bradleys. I was a platoon leader at the time. He was an executive officer. And we were focused on squadron and higher level operations. And that's what we focused on. We maneuvered all over the desert doing that. So a little later in our careers, we both kind of met up again in 2005, and we deployed to Iraq in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom 3. And at the time, we were in 3rd Squadron, 7th Cavalry Regiment. And at the time, I was just an S4 and also a member of a mid-team, a military transition team. Mike started off as an S1 and took command of one of the troops. And in his AO, he had a small town called Al-Dorea. And in there, he started instituting some of the things that we mentioned in the book. He started implementing a lot of successful counterinsurgency techniques. But at the time, I mean, we were out in Ras Al-Khaimah. He had to commute about an hour into his AO and had to commute about an hour out of his AO back to the FOB that we were in. But he learned a lot, and I learned a lot just watching him. So when we come back, he goes and becomes an observer controller at NTC. And at that time, I took command of one of the troops in 3-7 Cav. And I had a whole bunch of new lieutenants. And they didn't know that much. They didn't have that much experience. And so I was trying to figure out ways to train them and whatnot. And I was talking to Mike, who was at NTC, and he was observing a lot of units that were going through preparing to go to combat. And I was trying to get some advice from him. And he said, listen, you know, one of the things that effective units do, units that understand COIN and then empower their subordinate leaders to execute it are the ones that usually are the ones that do the best out there. And so I tried to do that. Shortly thereafter, I deployed in the beginning of 2000 or May of 2007 for the surge. We're part of 2nd Brigade, 3rd ID. And then I remember going and we went to the COIN Academy in Taji, and Dr. Kilcullen spoke. He had a lot of good points at that point. And then Tom Ricks talks a lot about that in his book as well as how they were trying to push a common theme from above all the way down to the ground level, which is where I was at. And the COIN Academy was a great experience. And again, you did go in detail. I think you even have the PowerPoint slides in the back of it. And so then we got assigned to the district or little area in Baghdad called Adamiya. And they had built, as you guys probably all know, a little wall around it. And then in my AO, I had a mosque called the Abu Hanifa Mosque. And within the first week that we were there, we got, during our patrols in the first week, we got attacked 12 times, just my troop. And it's very, again, I go back to the fundamentals. It's very easy to get wrapped up in the moment, you know, and you're thinking, and you get overwhelmed with emotions, and you got to be able to take a step back and think, okay, what are the fundamentals? What are some of the advice that I've gotten? And one of them was empowerment, which is what Mike had talked to me about. So what I try to do is push all that empowerment, empower my junior leaders as much as I could, which is, you know, my section sergeants, my platoon sergeants, my platoon leaders. And what I did is I gave them their own sectors of responsibility. I gave them people that they needed to focus on developing relationships with, different parts of the market where they could, you know, protect and then also help develop their economy by the use of, like, micro grants and micro loans. And what I realized is the more I empowered them, the more I actually learned, because they would learn things and they would turn around and come back to me and teach me things. So one of my junior leaders came up to me and said, hey, you know when you drink chai, and of course, you know, you sit there with a little saucer and you have chai. And he's saying, when you drink chai, what the older people do, instead of grabbing the cup and drinking out of the cup, which is extremely hot, and I had my tongue scorched a whole bunch of times trying to do it, they pour it into the saucer and then you drink out of it. But only the older, more distinguished gentlemen do that. So I was like, okay. So I went to a meeting a couple days later with a couple sheikhs, you know, older gentlemen, and they serve, you know, the chai as they always do. And I remembered, you know, what my junior leader had said, and so I did the same thing. We're talking business and whatnot, and I pour it into the little saucer, and then I drink out of the saucer. And the whole room, imagine a room this size, you know, there's a whole bunch of smoke because everybody smokes cigarettes. And everybody was just quiet, and they're just staring at me as I'm drinking out of the saucer. And they look at me. And I know why they're looking, but I just kind of go about my business as usual. And I'm like, okay, this is the way I've been taught. And they're like, oh, you're just like an Iraqi. You're just like an Iraqi. And that was great. I mean, it put us all at the same level, and it helped the negotiations after that. And then I just acted, oh, this is how I've always been taught, you know. I never really drank chai before Iraq, but that's the point of it. The point of it is, as you empower your junior leaders, or as I was empowering them, I guess, what I was learning is they were teaching me a lot more about counterinsurgency. And so during the time we were there, we incorporated the IA, the Sinzo Iraq program, and it was all successful. And by the time I changed command, we hadn't been attacked in 3 months. And it was really because of the junior leaders getting to know all the people and developing those relationships. And during that whole time while I was in Iraq, Mike and I were emailing each other back and forth. And he was continuing to see new things that were being developed, new ideas and new techniques, and he was sending them to me and helping me be half successful. And so what I wanted to talk about was the relationship between boxing and football. And I like both sports, actually. And empowerment and COIN and HIC, in my opinion, sort of match boxing and football, where football is more like HIC, high-intensity conflict, and boxing is more like COIN. And what I mean by that is, if you look at a boxer, right, he's sitting there and he's in front of his opponent, and he looks at the environment around him, And he can make split-second decisions whether to throw a jab, a right hook, a left hook, uppercut. Whereas in football, for example, you have a large formation, and once that ball snaps, you know, that wide receiver is running downfield or cutting to the left. Defensive end is going to do this. They're all running back is going to do that. They already have their set patterns. And granted, I mean, there are audibles and options and everything that you can do out there, but still, for the most part, once that ball is snapped, it's snapped. I mean, you're going to go on with what you have. And so it lends itself to a lot less flexibility and empowerment down to your junior leaders. But at the end of the day, I mean, if you're going to fight a big conventional army, you know, I wouldn't send a boxer out there. I'd send a football team, you know. So, but the point what I'm getting at is empowerment sort of is what kind of helped us be successful down there. So Phil Connors kind of understands that, the protagonist. He learns this throughout the six dreams, that he needs to develop relationships. And he needs to be adaptive in his applications of the fundamentals. So in the final dream, in the sixth dream, he's given a mission again to do the same thing as he was in the first dream. And right off the bat, he says, hey, I need extra materials. I need defense materials. I need, you know, concertina wire. I need all these extra things. So he's asking all this stuff that the commander hadn't even thought about giving him. And then after that, he also asks for humanitarian assistance bags, medical supplies, because he knows that non-lethal operations are kind of a key to that. And then he turns around and briefs the soldiers, and I'll conclude with this, is, gentlemen, we must gain the trust and confidence of the local population to achieve a secure environment. Without their active or passive support, the bad guys can't survive. Separating the insurgents from the population will be a frustrating, difficult task, but it can be done. And that's the essence of the fundamentals. And I'll pass it on to Mark.
I want to say thanks again for everybody for being here. This is great that CNAS is hosting this event. I just want to thank Jim again for working with me on the book. It's been great to do. This whole process has been fantastic with Tom Ricks and John Noggle and everybody at CNAS helping this thing along. As Jim said, the book's about adaptive leadership and working through complex problems. And for me, one of the primary reasons why I started working on the book was my experience at the National Training Center in California. After I commanded a cavalry troop with a 3-7 Cav in southeast Baghdad in 2005. I came back and became an observer controller. So for those of you that don't know, the National Training Center has changed a lot since the 1980s, since the 90s. We now have there's a different setup there, and the majority of the operations are focused on mission readiness exercises. And what you see there is they've incorporated Arabic-speaking role players. You've got urbanized terrain now. I believe they're building the largest urban training site in the world there now. And you see counterinsurgency operations being a theme of these mission readiness exercises. So it's really different than what I went through as an executive officer on the cavalry troop prior to 9/11. So as an observer controller in this environment, I was in a unique position to see firsthand how leaders were struggling with the adaptation or with the implementation of FM 324. Because when I first got there is when 324 came out, and everybody was reading it and trying to figure this thing out and see how it all fit in. So I saw how people were dealing with that. And I'll give you one example. On one occasion, I was coaching a unit that had a lot of difficulty accepting the fundamentals that the OCs were trying to teach them. This unit had just come back from a deployment from Iraq. And in that deployment, all their operations were being run from a single tactical operations center on a forward operating base, on a FOB. So big FOB, single talk. And essentially what would happen is the companies, with their captain and all their lieutenants and everything, would provide a patrol of whatever size, four vehicles, platoon, whatever it is. Those guys go up to the TOC, they turn in all their paperwork, and they go out on patrol, and then they are controlled by a battle captain with his radios or the operations officer out of the TOC. And there's one gigantic zone. So when Jim's talking about empowerment, essentially it's non-existent because you've got company commanders that have no control over their forces. Those ties that you need in counterinsurgency where people are talking together and linking together don't exist because 1 minute of patrol is in the north, 1 minute's in the south, essentially just driving around. So when they were at NTC, we saw them try and apply the same model at NTC, and we're geared to try and teach COIN at this point. And it took a little while. I mean, but by the end of the rotation, we began to bring them around to some of the principles and fundamentals in 324. But for me personally, I was surprised at just how little understanding of counterinsurgency fundamentals existed in this unit. And over the course of my time there, you saw different units at different levels, but this was one of the first ones that I saw when I got there. So that was something that I wanted to see, you know, how can we fix this? How can we create this understanding and this knowledge in our officer corps and our junior leaders? And specifically, I was struck by the steep learning curve for second lieutenants and the junior NCOs. Because as Jim has said, he and I had to learn how to fight a conventional battle. So we knew how to do PCCs, PCIs, our checks for combat. We knew how to line up and do a screen line. We knew how to do an attack, a defense. And we went through all of that stuff. And you have to learn how to be just a platoon leader in general. But on top of that, these guys were having to fight full-spectrum operations. So they needed to know not only everything that we knew, but they also had to learn how to talk to a sheikh, how to do a negotiation, how to do all these things that just weren't even in our vocabulary when Jim and I were coming up. So I realized that as steep as the learning curve was for us, it was even higher for these young junior guys, these junior NCOs, junior officers. So they need to be able to function in what's been called a hybrid battlefield. So we wanted to come up with a way to establish guidelines or guideposts for them with principles and fundamentals at the earliest stages of leadership development. We wanted to break it down to the basics. So I think one of the key components of the book is its simplicity. And E.D. Swinton's formula isn't something new that we've just kind of pulled out and, wow, this is something new. I mean, this has been used for almost a century now, I believe a century, to train officers in the United States and worldwide. And it's a format that has functioned well, and I think it functions well with our book in the transition. So we wanted a short and simple book that allows the lieutenant to quickly grasp the basics, but we wanted to do it in a compelling way where they would actually read it. And this is the kind of book where someone could read it on a plane ride in the theater. You know, I mean, we wanted something that someone would pick up, they'd feel compelled to read it, and they'd read through it, and they'd learn something from it. Because sometimes field manuals, no matter what they're about, read like stereo instructions. So we wanted something that somebody could look at and that they'd pay attention to. And I think the fictional account lets that happen. But the other theory with this is that it's simple, so guys will read it. So you're a lieutenant, you read this, you get some basic ideas, and then from that, it's kind of our gateway to counterinsurgency learning. So from that, they can read 324, they can read 324.2, which just came out, the new tactics counterinsurgency manual. And then they can read Galula, Thompson, Noggle, Kilcullen, Fischel, they can read Mao, Guevara. They continue to read and continue to study and build on the knowledge, that basic stuff that we're giving them. So the idea being that this book, no matter what's going on with doctrine, will be out there as a baseline for guys to start with. And that it would be part of basic leadership schooling, be that the officer basic course, basic non-commissioned officers course, West Point, ROTC, something that they could read, retain, and then apply, and they could apply to any situation they encountered. So we didn't want to give them a, hey, this is how you do it, but we wanted to give them a kind of some lanes to stay in. And adding on to that, because we wanted to keep the book short, on the website, like Tom Ricks mentioned, we also added professional development exercises where they can get in-depth. So instructors, if they want to pull something more out of the book, they can develop that. It's kind of a framework from which you can train your leaders. So that was kind of how we went into it. But then we were also surprised to find that when we had the manuscript, we'd give it to some friends and family, and they'd read it, and they would get a lot out of it. So we're like, well, that's fantastic. And I guess the same simple format that we developed for junior leaders without a whole lot of experience fits right in and makes it approachable for people that don't have a lot of military experience, a lot of military background. It's a simple and easy way for people to learn what counterinsurgency looks like, where policy meets reality. And a lot of times there's a gap where you see the big picture and you see the guy shooting somebody on the news, but you don't really see the whole picture on why everything's going on and why it's so difficult. So I think it helps explain why Iraq and Afghanistan have progressed how they have and why those types of wars are so difficult. So one good example of that is I was just assigned to Monterey not too long ago. I go to a coffee shop every morning to get coffee, and I met the owner, and we talk every once in a while. And one time I went in uniform, and we started talking about Iraq. And he seemed like I think he just wanted to say what he thought I wanted to hear. And one of the things he said was, you know, you guys are fighting over there with one hand tied behind your back. You know, the implication being that we have overwhelming firepower, we've got unquestionable military might, we've got a clear technological advantage. Obviously, this is a matter of political will. We're just not willing to do what we need to do to finish the job. So obviously, there's some kind of disconnect going on. That's why we haven't finished this thing in 100 days. So it's more of a matter of will, not means. So what I think for him, you know, he reads Defense of Jisr al-Durayh. It does a good job explaining why there are rules of engagement. which sometimes you don't get the full picture. And it not only, rules of engagement not only protect the civilian population, but also enable soldiers to better identify combatants. And also in the book, you see the implications of the use of force, and you see the effects. Jim talks about effects. When you use force, there's an effect, and that's something we wanted to make clear in the book. And the fact that it's fictional allows you to see not just, hey, this is what you should be doing, but if you don't do it, this is what happens. If you do do it, this is what is probably going to happen. So we wanted to make sure we show that. And you see that in the book when Lieutenant Connors reacts with overwhelming force after a sniper attack. Essentially, he takes a casualty, and he decides that he's just going to do what we describe as a mad minute, where he engages everything that could be a possible sniper location around his perimeter. And in the process, he kills several civilians. And then we go ahead and amp that up for him and provide some international media on the scene so you get a strategic effect out of his mistake. So the reader's able to realize immediately what the effects are when you take certain actions and how that works out. We also describe an event in the book in which Lieutenant Connors uses his platoon to conduct a random cordon search. He takes a large chunk of the village he's in charge of and says, hey, I'm sick of getting attacked. We're going to roll through here. We're going to search every house. We're going to pull everybody out. We're going to rough them up and make sure they know, you know, if you attack our base, then you're going to feel the effects of that. So, but I think what comes out of the book is that as Connors is sitting there, he ends up seeing one gentleman pulled out of his house, zip-tied and kind of bloodied, and all the women crying in the corner, and all they find is an AK-47. And he's like, you know, maybe this isn't working. And it kind of clicks for a second in his head, and then the dream continues, and it's one of the lessons at the end. So he ends up kind of seeing how the heavy-handed actions can actually create more insurgents, because at the end of that dream you see an increase in attacks rather than a decrease. So we try and show that technology and firepower is just one ingredient of fighting counterinsurgency, but you've got to have a holistic picture. So to close there, I think that breaking down the complexities of counterinsurgency in an easy-to-read format makes it possible for media consumers to develop a better context for why these types of conflicts are so difficult. And it also provides you a little more understanding of why the setbacks have occurred, and more than that, how impressive the recent accomplishments are, the things that Jim has done, just how difficult that situation is and how hard it is to find success. And I hope that that's what the book is able to do for the readers. So I think that's all the comments that we have.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think that's a very good opening session. Open up to questions now. I'm going to begin with two. How has the Army reacted, especially TRADOC? And second, why did it take the U.S. Army so damn long to adjust in Iraq, to go through six dreams, or I would call six nightmares?
Well, I think I'll talk about the second question. And I remember listening to Petraeus saying that it takes 9 to 10 years to be able to go into a country and wage a successful counterinsurgency operation. So if I think of how many years we've been there, 2003, we're 2008, so 2009, 6 years. We set our forces out of there by 2011, I think. So I think the way I look at it is, you know, a military size as big as it is right now, for me, it's kind of astonishing how quickly we've been able to change our strategy, and not that I know that much at that level, but just even at the tactical level, how we've been able to transition from what we were training as second lieutenants in high-intensity conflict, and then quickly turn it around in just a couple of years and be able to launch a successful counterinsurgency campaign in Iraq. And I think speaks volumes of how well the military has done. You know, at being able to successfully implement a counterinsurgency. And I think also there's another portion of it that, you know, there are two sides to everything. So what I mean by that is there's military, which is the Blue Force, and then you have, you know, the Iraqis. And so it takes time to develop a relationship between two countries as it does with any one person. So over time, you don't just walk in and all of a sudden have trust between two people. It takes time in developing those relationships, both nationally and all the way down to the individual level. Takes time. So I look at it as it, we've done it pretty quickly.
And the Army reaction, TRADOC reaction?
As far as TRADOC goes, I was writing the book, like you said, at the National Training Center. So for the most part, I think the feedback from my peers and from the leaders there, I mean, we were teaching counterinsurgency there was fairly positive. So I haven't seen any negative comments from anyone from TRADOC. No one's talked to me about that. The only, I'm taking the intermediate course here, the CGSC course at Fort Belvoir. We're reading, as part of the course, we read John Noggle and Colonel Gentile. So we kind of look at the balance that they want to strike there with counterinsurgency forces versus high-intensity conflict forces. And we also read the Secretary of Defense's comments about finding a balance, about building capability. So, you know, that's all stuff that's out there. And Colonel Gentile has commented on the book, and obviously he didn't find it, you know, that compelling of an argument or that compelling of a book. He believed, because he thinks it takes a leap of faith. I mean, I kind of disagree. I think population-centric counterinsurgency may not always be what we need to do. Sometimes enemy-centric might be the way to go. Depending, it's like we've been saying, there's fundamentals you got to apply them to what you're looking at. But I think it's something very valuable to keep in the kit bag. So, like I said, the only real negative thing that I've seen so far has been Colonel Gentile's comments. But other than that, I think overall it's been fairly positive.
I'd be curious, taking this from the realm of dreams, which I find a really fascinating concept, to the realm of reality, to hear both of you describe, from your experiences in Iraq, what sort of the key moments, or moment, if there is one, that where it dawned on you, we've entered a situation for which we essentially, if this is true, haven't been fully trained for, and we need to adapt ourselves to what we're seeing on the ground. So if there is a moment like that, or even just a kind of gradual evolution of your thinking from your experiences deployed, you were both in Baghdad, it sounds like, at various times. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to hear that.
Well, for me, probably the most striking, I wasn't prepared for it moment was, I'm a cavalry officer, and I was deployed as a logistics officer, which you don't get a whole lot of training for to get go. So in 2003, I went in as the S4 for my cavalry squadron, and I got a little bit of training on being the guy that was in charge of the money to buy local stuff off the economy. So when I got to Allenbar, we basically had to establish, I guess it'd be base camps. We ended up establishing in the Haditha Dam and then in a small train station. And probably my first and biggest blunder in counterinsurgency would be as a buying officer, that I purchased like a $700 horrible tent from the local mayor of Haditha, which really we never even put up. So I was completely incompetent at doing negotiations, being a logistics officer, buying a tent. But just the fact that I had to meet somebody and say, hey, I need to get a tent for these guys to sleep in, and I had to do it through a translator. We had one in the entire squadron, and by the way, he was a local key leader, which I probably shouldn't have been dealing with him buying stuff in the first place. So that was like, almost one of the first things I did once we got on the ground, and that strikes me as something where I just completely was out of my league. Beyond the second time I was there in 2005, something that turned out different, that changed over time. When I first became a troop commander, we did a large operation where we targeted an area where we were getting hit by IEDs every other day or something like that. And so we set up like an ambush site overwatching it. And sure enough, some guys came out and were digging and were messing around. But I was a little unsure of myself whether we should go ahead and engage these guys or not. And we ended up not engaging them. We ended up maneuvering on them, and we lost most of them, but we captured one guy. He was a young guy from a nearby town. So I got really down on myself for quite a while, because I'm like, you know, that was obvious. You know, why didn't I just shoot these guys? I should have just shot these guys. We would have been done with this. We're still getting IEDs. What's going on? But over the course of the deployment, I kind of started to realize, you know, if we killed those guys, I mean, who knows who we would kill? Instead, we captured a guy. We got some intel out of him. And in the end, we captured more guys in that cell. And I think, looking back on it, it was the right decision, even though it was probably made for, at the time, I thought of it as a blunder. But oftentimes, if you kill guys, you get less out of it than if you capture them. And that was something that I realized while I was in theater, which was interesting for me.
I think similar to me, actually, too, is, and I mentioned before that, you know, we were getting attacked quite a bit the first week. I mean, it was 12 times just while on patrol. And again, I was trying to figure out how to get information, you know, find out where the bad guys were. And so we figured, you know, the only way to do it really was get informants. But the informants come from the public, and so how do you get that? And so I was lucky. I mean, I was trying to think of ways. At first, I was just asking them, potentially would just say, hey, we're the bad guys. And they'd be like, I'm not going to tell you.
Right.
You know, and they would just turn around and walk away. And so it came to me, like, when I was growing up, I lived in Peru during the 80s. The Shining Path was in charge at the time. So we had blackouts every day and, you know, car bombs every day and curfew all the time. And so the more I thought about it, it's kind of similar to Baghdad. The only difference is I was a child. I was 10, 11, 12 years old living there. You know, and this time I was the military. So completely different, but it's kind of the same. And so I guess what I tried was I sat down and I said, hey, listen, I've been in your... One day one of the Iraqis was like, you don't understand what I'm going through, blah, 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 blah. You know, and so I said, well, you know, when I was a little kid, I actually lived in Peru, and this is what I went through. And I said, oh, well, so then you do understand. And it worked, and it took me about several weeks to figure that out. I wish I would have known right off the bat. But you got to have an in, for lack of a better term. And once I started doing that, he started giving me information, and then he would hand me off to friends of his, and before long, I mean, we were doing nightly raids. But instead of doing what I remember in 2005 is large movements, we'd cordon off two blocks and go through every house. We would grab the informant, give him ACUs, put him in the car, you know, cover him up, and he would take us right to the house. And we'd go in, do the raid, capture the guy, say, that's the guy, you know, positively ID the guy. And it was, that changed the whole dynamics of it, because all of a sudden we were relating with them, and they were allowing us to be lethal without disturbing anybody else, with minimal collateral damage.
Yeah, great. Great introduction and presentation. I really like the idea that you guys have expressed in terms of creating something that junior leaders are going to have as a real tool, a resource, and something that's accessible to them. And along those lines, I really wonder if you've thought about, you know, how to, I don't want to say market, but that's exactly right. Last week, I was down at VMI, and I was invited to give a presentation to the Army's ROTC Marshall Award winners, which are it's the number one cadet from every ROTC program across the country. And I was given a roundtable on the Americas, so I had a chance to talk with about a third of these guys. And we were talking about Colombia, and we got to counterinsurgency. So I asked a question. I said, how many of you in your military science preparation, again, these are the top guys of the Army's ROTC across the entire country, so how many of you have had in your instruction have had anything about counterinsurgency? And about less than a third said, you know, raise their hands and said yes. And I, you know, you think about it, makes sense, because the guys that run these the ROTC programs are old guys that you kind of described before that know about, you know, like you talk the guy that you talked to in the coffee shop there. You know, it's just political. We'll just get out there and do it. So I think it's a wonderful way to get access through this next generation of leaders through the ROTC to get these guys already prepared for it. I don't know if you've made any inroads in there. If not, I'd be happy to send a copy of this to the head of the cadet command, the guy at TRADOC that handles all that for you, because I think it's a wonderful way to do it.
Yeah, that'd be absolutely great.
Yeah,
sure.
We're not, I'm going to be honest with you, we're not really good at marketing.
Right. I mean, we sent out some copies to some people. Mostly we sent them to people that were important in our career, and I think Jim and I have been really lucky, sort of just because we've had lots of good mentors in our career, so we made sure that they all got copies, and then I think one of his old NCOs is actually at the Marshall Conference, which I was an award winner, by the way, so we can...
So you know the deal.
I know, but one of his former platoon sergeants, I think, was there,
yeah,
and he discussed the book a little bit there.
Who was that?
Sergeant Lugo.
I saw him. I didn't.
You did see him? Yeah, he went. Right. He was actually one of my platoon sergeants this last rotation. And so, I gave him a copy of the book, and then he called me. He's like, hey, I'm going to the Marshall Conference. I'm going to try to hand it out. Okay.
But absolutely, that's the goal, is that no matter what's going on with, maybe we're fighting a high intensity conflict somewhere, and COIN is the last thing people are thinking about. It's just stuck somewhere on some syllabus, so that somebody has to read this as a cadet or in their basic course. So even if it's not relevant at the time, it gets in their head, so they at least know where to go back and look, where the bibliography is, where they go, oh, here it is. So.
Well, I'll send it on.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks,
absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Price?
Yeah. I read the book a couple months ago when you guys sent me a copy of it, and this is a comment, not a not really a question, actually a couple comments. Number one, when I read it, I didn't, I mean, I saw COIN, you know, versus high intensity, but also I didn't see that. What I saw was an officer learning how to handle the situation that was in front of him. In this particular case, it was COIN, but I saw that the lessons to take away was, you know, what's the environment you're in? What is needed? And that if you read this and try to take a step back, that you could also see, okay, if this high intensity was needed, that high intensity is what you bring. Number one. Number two, the lessons here in this book are not just for young military leaders. And I think you alluded to that in your comments about your family and friends. The lessons in here are something that junior and middle business people can take. I've learned lessons in it for the think tank, for a small entrepreneurial think tank. So when thinking about marketing or something like that, you should keep that in mind too. It really is a great book. It's a quick read. It's something that I've gone back to a couple times already. I congratulate you guys on this. It's really an amazing feat. And don't stop. So I'm not sure if you have to develop a tank. Also, you have a few years for that.
Sure.
98 to, or 89, when was it, 1898?
Yeah, so like 16 years.
So you got 16
years. You got 16 years to figure it out.
But don't do that 22, because I think that's what
the floating tank or something.
Exactly.
That's interesting, because something that, one of the reasons we put defense in there is not only when I was in theater, but also at NTC, guys would completely blow off setting up a defense the right way, and it made me furious out of my mind. I'm like, and then they would just basically say, well, you know, what's the threats? And guys running around with AK. I'm like, you still do a sector sketch. You still set in a deep, there's nothing different. Just because you're in an environment where you talk to a sheikh doesn't mean you still need security. So that's one of the reasons that the first lesson is, because if you don't do security right, no matter what you're doing, you set yourself up for failure. And yeah, I think it's been interesting, friends and family reading it, or other people. It seems like they do get a lot out of it, which is good. It's in that simple format.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Jit Till, and so I'd be curious to hear your take, especially your perspective from the MTC. Say a captain has taken his company through an NTC rotation, he's deployed, and it's the tail end of his deployment, he's been drinking tea with the sheiks and doing all that. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, he has to go confront a battalion-sized militia that's pretty good in small unit tactics and all. How good do you think his ability to transition, to adapt to that new threat,
right,
to call for fire, the basics of fire and maneuver? Right. How much problem do you think he'd have with him?
And that's a big dilemma. And we did some some larger scale missions at NTC to try and get a little more into full spectrum, so they're not just doing one or the other. And I don't have the answer at all. I know that the big discussion that's always come up whenever I've talked to, when I was on NTC, was for armor guys, the in-stride breach of a mine wire obstacle, because that is the end-all be-all of the armor, heavy armor, mechanized combat, combined arms community. Can you do the combined arms in-stride breach of a complex mine wire obstacle? And people would train their entire lives and come to NTC and fail horribly to breach the mine wire obstacle in the face of the op floor. So that's, whenever you talk about the atrophy of high-intensity conflict, that comes up, and gunnery skills come up.
Yeah.
And I talked about what we've been learning at CGSC. We read the Nagel piece about winning the wars we're in versus Gentile's discussion of high-intensity. And I don't have the answer. I know that I don't really have the answer. I just know that you need to be able to do a little of both. And I think like I said, looking at Secretary Gates' comments about finding a balance, finding a capability, the right mix of capability is important. But I think no COIN is obviously not the answer, and no HIC is obviously not the answer. It's somewhere in between, some kind of mix of capabilities where we can do a lot.
Yeah. And I think the Army, I mean, a lot of the leaders, I think, have recognized that. And what I saw new over the last year and a half or 2 years before I left 3rd ID was, and I'm sure other units might have been doing it for a while, but I mean, we always had our medal, which was a mission essential task list. But over the last several years, it's kind of gone out the window. And within the last year and a half or so, they've come up with C medal, D medal. which is C metal is your core metal, core mission essential task list, and D metal, which is your directed or deployed, whichever acronym you want to use. And so, and there's this nice little chart that they have, which, you know, shows basically two triangles coming together and merging. And so the unit's supposed to at first kind of focus on their D metal or C metal before they know where they're going to deploy. So they're back for a year and a half, 18 months of all time. And then they focus on their D metal, which is, you know, your gunneries, you know, all your basic hit tasks. And then at some point, based on where you're going to deploy, because you don't even know, you get a LAD or, you know, when you're going to deploy, whether it's Afghanistan or, you know, or to Iraq. And then at that point, at some point in between, you start transitioning over. And again, it's not perfect, but we're already starting to, I think, down at battalion levels and below, try and identify which metal and what point you transition and you start focusing on some of your C metal tasks or your D metal tasks, which is your deployed metal. What's interesting is down to the individual level, some of the stuff is just really basically the same sometimes, and which we're identifying. You know, so, you know, going out there and being able to shoot your weapon,
sure,
right? You know, and being able to maintain 360-degree security. Well, guess what? We still got to do it, as we talked about in the book. And once you start practicing for your D-metal,
maybe for infantry, not for artillery.
Well, that's true. That's true. And then that's part of the 360-degree battlefield. And it might lend itself a little easier for infantry and for armor, but still, I mean, in the beginning, then the artillery can train on all the artillery tasks. You know, and they transition to their D-metal and start focusing on some of the more infantry basic tasks if they're going to be doing that. Because what's interesting is, even in our last deployment, in OIF-5, I don't remember any of our artillery battalions really ever firing any indirect. But during the surge, and Jason Fritz was down there, you know, 19 FA were actually firing, were using their artillery rounds,
mm-hmm,
because we were fighting we were doing a lot of kinetic operations, lethal operations. So had we just focused on our D metal from the get-go, that FA battalion would have never been able to fire those rounds. They even fired the Excalibur round, which is a new round that's GPS honed in.
Right.
And so there's a balance.
I'm going to do my best to do two things here, which is, one, complete a thought that I haven't quite completed, and try to put it in the form of a question. It was triggered by a comment that Price made about how this thesis of adaptive leadership has relevance in other arenas, business, think tank, etc. here's where it starts to get tricky. I gather that this book, and I haven't read it yet, I will, is about the successful strategy employed in Iraq. That earlier this week at a session at the Council on Foreign Relations where John Nagel was dealing with Afghanistan, the questions came up and the response that John and others gave was, we've got the right strategy in Afghanistan, we're woefully under-resourced, but, you know, we're going to make it. Then you and I were talking just before the session started about today's dual suicide in Iraq. I'm thinking about Tom's in the afterword to this book about the tree of the forbidden fruit, or the fruit of the forbidden tree, or whatever.
Fruit of the poison tree.
Fruit of the poison tree. A long-winded way of trying to get somewhere. And where I'm trying to get is, you've written, I gather, something that is appropriate to train young people, new people coming up in the military, about a successful military strategy. What we know about Iraq and Afghanistan is, no matter how successful that piece is, if the other piece, the civilian and political piece, isn't successful, it doesn't matter what you do here. And my question is, I think, is there a companion book that someone could write on the civilian and or political side, and or is there something in here that could be marketed, interpreted, etc., for those reasons? I don't know if that's a complete thought or a question. It's the best I can do right now.
Sounds like a great idea. A companion book sounds pretty good. But I know one of the, and they hadn't read it, but the, towards the end, one of the lessons is, I believe it's Dream 5, he gets everything right. And he succeeds as a military officer in achieving stability. But he's running everything. He's got the projects coming from U.S. dollars. He's running the projects. He's running the medical stuff. He's working with the locals. He's got everything fixed. And then at the end of that dream, he gets reassigned because everything's stable. So he leaves. The insurgents come in. Everybody he worked with gets killed. And he's wondering what happened. And then and the lessons that he learns out of that are, well, if we don't get linked into civilian agencies, be they international NGOs, or more importantly, the actual local nationals, the local governments, and the local security forces, then you're not going to be successful. So that's in the book. We don't specifically go into how civilian agencies should work with the military because we thought it would be a little bit, it would add too much. But that's something that obviously could be pulled out of there.
The problem is the State Department still stuck in Dream 1. And it's more like Groundhog Day. So you can re-dream Dream 1 and do it the same way. In fact, I'm not sure who announced that for Afghanistan, as they ramp up, because the President called for a dramatically increased civilian presence, and the Defense Department agreed with that completely, and therefore the Defense Department is sending in people. Because there's no one else. There's no civilian, there are none. There's no ag people that we have. And so they're sending in reservists who have this stuff, or people in the National Guard who have agricultural experience or legal experience. So, but once again, I mean, the civilian, but they're civilian experience, but they're wearing uniforms. So it's still, they're not quite, I'm not sure what dream that would be then. It's more than one, but it's not six yet.
23.
You can call it the Foggy Bottom.
Shannon, the boss, has a follow-up.
You described in your opening remarks and in the book that successfully implementing a COIN strategy involves protecting the population, working with the population, understanding the population. Is there cultural or historical training being done in COIN preparations before you're deployed? And if so, if it is, then what is that training? And if not, should there be that
training? Sure, I think you can,
because
you actually went through it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of training that happens, and Mike can sort of go into some of the training that happens at NTC regarding cultural awareness and whatnot. Prior to going to the country, a lot of units are, you know, there's a program, I think, similar to Rosetta Stone, called Tactical Iraqi. Mm-hmm. And what it does is, Rosetta Stone is a really good program. But the problem with Rosetta Stone is not necessarily focused on some of the speaking that we're going to be doing, which is kind of military-based, some of the negotiations we're going to do. We're not really going to cover in Rosetta Stone. So, I mean, I don't know who developed the program, but it's a similar, basically the same type of scenario-based type program, mm-hmm. which they can learn that. And then what we also found was over time, and it sort of leads to sort of what you were saying, you know, why a lot of things happen quicker. Well, everybody's become a lot more tolerant of each other. So over time, we've become a lot better in understanding which are the key things that you got to know, what you don't need to know. You know, Iraqis are a lot more patient, you know, now that if you do something wrong, like show the bottom of your feet by mistake, they're not going to all of a sudden get offended because they realize, hey, you know, you're used to sitting sometimes with your legs crossed, and, mm-hmm. you know, and then you realize and you correct, and they won't go awry with it mentally. And so there's a lot of manuals out there. We do a lot of training with it. We do a lot of kind of scenarios where we have role players come in even before we go to NTC, and then Mike will talk about what they do in NTC, and what you have people who are looking for those cultural aspects and whatnot. And again, word of mouth. I mean, one of the things that I learned too was, you know, you do the kisses, you do the man kiss, but one thing I did was one day I did it, and actually I would kiss their shoulder instead. And I don't know if you knew this, but I would kiss her shoulder, and then, at least in the Sunni area where I was at, and they're like, that's exactly how we all do it here, yeah. You know, and they were all excited, so I would give them three kisses on the shoulder, you know, and that small little things like that made all the difference in the world, so,
And that's just word of mouth. I mean, it takes time to develop those.
And at the training centers, they do, at least when I was there, they do negotiation scenarios with Arabic speakers or wherever you're going to go, I guess Dari or Pashtun, depending on what the scenario is. And then they also get cultural classes. They get a negotiation class itself. And then they, while they're in training, there's role players, and they all speak Arabic or the language that they're going to deal with. So they have to do negotiations. They get to contact. They get contact with them, both positive and negative. And so they deal with it a lot at the CTCs. And I think a good model, if you look at it, is what I believe it's General McMaster's now. What he did with 3rd ACR before they left was fantastic. I looked at the AAR from 3rd ACR, and how he really focused in on language, culture, and understanding that's an excellent model. And a lot of units are looking at what 3rd ACR did to try and prep themselves for their train up.
Back here.
Counterinsurgency has been counterintuitive for the most part. It seems to me every time a lieutenant, a captain, whoever gets out of the convoy, gets out of the Humvee and goes and interacts. And the soldiers, guys still sitting in the turret, guys still sitting in the Humvee. I want to get a sense of what you think. What are the grunts, the guys on the ground, you know, you guys read this stuff. Where are they in the process?
Well, one of the big differences we had between 2005 and 2007 was just the amount of interpreters we had. And also, I mean, if I were to look at RAO specifically, I mean, we had a troop, which is only about 100, 115 soldiers, and RAO was the size of 1 kilometer by 1.5 kilometers. Now, granted, there was 100,000 people in that little square, but there was a lot more boots on the ground, and so it allowed us to split up a little more. And instead of sending just one platoon or one interpreter with one patrol, we'd send out two interpreters. And so it was down to the squad level, and it was really the squad leaders at that point. Squad leaders, patrol leaders, E6s primarily, which were the ones that were doing a lot of the talking and whatnot. And then you're right. I mean, down to E1 to E4, they're still maintaining 360-degree perimeter, basically the fundamentals of defense, wherever we are. Because it doesn't take that much for someone to, you know, walk up with a suicide, you know, IED and walk up and blow. So they're still all focused on everything around them. But I think one of the biggest differences is over time, we've empowered all the way down to E6s, senior E5s. They're doing a lot of the talking and negotiating, whereas I think earlier on it was maybe the captain no more lower than the lieutenant level. So I think that's some of the dynamics that have changed, and we've empowered our subordinate leaders.
Are the ones in the E4s getting it?
Well, they are. I mean, if I think about my E6s and my E5s, they were all E1s in their first deployment. So E6, I mean, all of my E6s were E4s in OIF3. You know, and so they got to sit back and watch and learn and see how their NCOs did. And there's nothing better than, you know, leading by example. So, I want to learn to be that guy. I want to be that E6. I want to be that guy in charge of the squad and be the guy negotiating. You know, and that's what they eventually did. So,
but I think something really interesting, something we found at NTC, I keep going back to that because it was a great opportunity to just look at how different units do things. And one of the things that we saw across the board, and one of the reasons for the book, is that when you had a troop commander or a company commander that got it, everyone got it in his unit. He was like the linchpin. Because if he understood COIN and he set the tone, then everyone underneath him down to the E1 understood what was going on. And they would treat people different. They would be more respectful, but still be able to use lethal force, be able to switch on and off, because they understood, because he talked to them about it. But if you had a guy at the company command level, at that particular space, that didn't get it, and was wandering around looking to cause some violence because he thought that's what he needed to do, then guys wouldn't get it. And you'd see more of the privates pushing around the role players or yelling at people or pointing their weapons at people for no reason. So one of the reasons for the book is if you can get lieutenants and captains to get it from the get-go, that it kind of goes down to the privates because they're kind of like a blank page. I mean, whatever you fill them with and train them with, they're going to execute, be that taking a hill or playing nice with the locals if they need to. So it seems to vary on the unit. So like with Jim's guys, it's going to be good because he gets it. Somebody else, it could be bad. It really, and that company commander, and then for that, if we can get it down to the lieutenants, if they can all get it, then you'll see everybody kind of gets it.
I was talking to a battalion commander recently about having to relieve a company commander and two platoon leaders. in the first 6 months of a tour, because they basically not only didn't get it, but didn't want to get it.
Right.
And he just decided, you know, you're not a bad guy, but you're going to have to, you know, go be the S1, or I'm going to create something for you to get you out of that building.
Right.
How did you come up with the name Phil Connors? I kept on thinking of Phil Silvers and Tim Connors.
We had as a starting point Arnold something. I forget. It was a mixture of two of our lieutenants' names from two of our lieutenants.
Yeah.
And then John Noggle, when he read the book, he came back and said, "Hey, why don't you use Phil Connors?" I'm like, "Who's Phil Connors?" I'm Googling it, and then it comes up. It's Bill Murray's character in Groundhog Day.
Oh.
That's who it is. So that's why we went with it.
To me. Huh.
So good. Well, underlying meaning.
A great American cultural reference.
Yeah. Right.
Did you get that price?
I did.
Okay.
The great thing, I mean, for I'm a big Bill Murray fan.
Huge.
One of the interview questions here is, what's your favorite Bill Murray movie?
So the reason Groundhog Day in the movie and why this book is because what happens, what Phil Connors does in the movie, some people watch it as a comedy, right? And he's funny, he does slapstick, oh, isn't that great? What happens is because he's reliving the same day over and over again, and finally, he accepts the situation as it is and decides to start learning for himself. And as he learns, he has to go it's almost like Maslow's fear of hierarchy as well. And he also gets rid of the seven deadly habits, of gluttony, he goes through all envy, he goes through all those things too. And he finally becomes, you know, a whole person. And only then, once he accepts himself and the situation he's in, only then can he actually be able to, the girl falls in love with them, and they'll be in. And just like in this book, finally when they get it all, that's only when it works. And they finally accept, they need to do this, treat these people like real human beings, they're equals and stuff, does it work.
What's your theory of Caddyshack?
But if you were able to combine California Sensimilla with Kentucky Bluegrass, like it did in Caddyshack, then that would be
amazing. I just want to do a follow-up. I'm still thinking about the same issue. I'm interested to know, at this point, how many people do you think have read this, number one? Number two, I mean, it's a very round number.
Sure.
I mean, 10, 100, 1,000. Second, where are they? Mostly military or military-related. And third, where I was headed was, not having read the book, what value would the NGO community, USAID, et cetera, get from reading this?
Well, I think how many people have read it?
I'm just curious.
That's a good question. Maybe a couple thousand.
Well, it could be even more. I mean, we originally dropped it as a rough PDF file, which I think was in English. But after the editors got done, it seems like it reads a lot better. But we dropped that so that people could download it, like lieutenants could download it on some of the sites. So several thousand. I don't know what the actual number would be.
And do you have a sense? I mean, do you have a sense that they are sort of military or military related, or is there no way to know that at this point?
At this point, I don't know.
That's a very good question. But I think, it's been spreading even throughout my family, and I have an extended family, so that always helps out to kind of push it through the civilian population or the non-military people.
But specifically, what about that NGO USAID? I mean, is this anything that would, I am read it, so I don't know whether it would be relevant, but it's back to that question about the partnership.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. Same as I was talking about before, people without military experience, but it's even more important, I think, to talk about USAID, those NGOs, because I think a lot of times, in my dealings with those kind of folks, sometimes they go into it thinking that we're just, you know, eating red meat and wanting to shoot people all day. So this book kind of gives you a better idea of, hey, maybe we don't just want to shoot people all day. This is really complicated. So when you're doing security and you're trying to do counterinsurgency, people are going to make mistakes, and maybe they don't mean to do it, but they want to be successful. They want to achieve their mission. And I think this book shows just how complicated it is and how we're trying to do the right thing. Sometimes we don't, and we could really use their help. And when they see where there's gaps, I think if you were USAID and you read this book, you'd go, wow, I could really help him in this dream. Man, I'd go right there and do this. Or
also, the corollary would be in Iraq. The guy who comes in and says, I know what we'll do. We'll build a school. And they let a contract to the local Sunnis, and so the local Shiites burn it. And so they built another school, and this time the contractor says, you mean you'll rebuild it every time we burn it? I'll burn it. know, in sort of like that lesson of right. that series of lessons that people arrive at, mm-hmm. you could do very much the equivalent. It'd be a wonderful thing for the State Department coin people to do as a sort of corollary.
Absolutely.
Do we have any other questions here? Okay, I think we should release people and people can talk to you, get their book signed, whatever they like. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.